You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. If you listen to the show regularly, I'd love to ask you the favor of rating us in iTunes, liking us on Facebook, and tweeting about the show. You can find us on Twitter at Write the Book. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Paula Martinac, whose new novel, The Ada Decades, came out this spring from Bywater Books. Paula Martinac is the author of three other novels, the Lambda Literary Award-winning Out of Time, the Lammy-nominated Home Movies, and Chicken. Paula's other publications include three nonfiction books and numerous articles, essays, and short stories on LGBT themes. Most recently, Paula's short stories appeared in the Raleigh Review, Minerva Rising, and Main Street Rag. She blogs about queer history and historic sites at the queerest places. Also a playwright, Paula's plays have had productions with Pittsburgh Playwrights Theater Company, Manhattan Theater Source, the Pittsburgh New Works Festival, the Ganymede Festival, No Name Players, and others. Her full-length screenplay, Foreign Affairs, about the love affair between journalist Dorothy Thompson and novelist Krista Winslow, finished second place in the 2003 Power Up Screenwriting Contest. In 2014, she and her wife, writer and professor Katie Hogan, moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, where Paula teaches creative writing to undergraduates at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Here's a little information about the Ada Decades. A girl from a Carolina mill family isn't supposed to strive for a career, but Ada Shook graduates from college on a scholarship and lands a plum job as a school librarian. As the 1950s South rocks with turbulence, Ada finds herself caught in the ugly fight to integrate the Charlotte, North Carolina public schools. At the same time, she makes friends with Cam Lively, a teacher who challenges her to reexamine her narrow upbringing. The two women fall in love and throw in their lot together despite their underlying fear of being found out and fired. Over seven decades, Ada is witness to the racism laced through her southern city, the paradox of religion as both comfort and torment, and the survival networks created by gay people. 11 interconnected stories cover the sweep of one woman's personal history as she reaches her own form of southern womanhood, compassionate, resilient, principled, and lesbian. I began my interview with Paula Martinac by asking about how the early part of the book ties into race and sexual identity in the time period leading up to and including the civil rights movement. How did she choose this time period as a starting point?
I wrote this book sort of backwards, actually. It started as a short story, a chapter in the book that's called Comfort Zone, that's at toward the end of the book,
right.
That takes place in 2015. And that was the first story that I wrote, and I was actually writing a series of stories about an older man with dementia named Harry Finn, who's in that story, and about how he moves to North Carolina to live with his daughter and wanders into the yard of this woman in Charlotte, North Carolina, who turned out to be Ada Shook. And I was so taken with Ada. It started out to be Harry's story, but as I wrote it, it was clear to me that it was her story. As she started to, the character started to reveal things to me about herself, that she had been a school librarian, that I knew she was a widow, and then that she was a lesbian who had lost her partner.
Okay.
And so I started from there, and then I became really interested in her life and thought that it would – I also really like the structure of novels and stories.
Yeah.
And I thought it would make a great way to tell her story, because I didn't want to tell the story from the point of view of an older woman looking back and having all these flashbacks. So I started this is a long answer to your question, but I started from there in 2015 and started looking back and counting back the decades to what she would have seen in her life. And I realized that she was starting her career just as integration was happening in the South, in Charlotte, and, you know, throughout the South, on that one day, September 4th, 1957, is a historic day when that happened across the South.
Right.
And from there, I was trying to decide what I wanted to show about her life, and I wanted to show her as a young girl and what the influences on her might have been, and to show her first encounters with racial violence, and what may have formed her identity and what may have lent contributed to her moral compass,
yes,
and how she might see the world and see her society. And so that was why I found myself going back to 1947 when she's just shy of 12 years old,
yeah,
and she's having this experience finding a photograph of a lynching.
Right.
And so that seemed to me like a good starting point for her. And then from there, going forward, it was clear to me that everything in her career as a school librarian in the South was going to be tinged with race and was going to have to deal with how she, as a white woman, you know, would eventually find herself trying to be an ally to the African-American students and to an African-American teacher.
Yeah, that was really interesting, too.
Yeah, it seemed to me that was, I didn't realize it at first when I wrote about her as an old woman, but it became clear to me as I started thinking about her that race was really, in addition to sexuality, these were really the two issues, and class as well. These were really the issues that were going to permeate her life and carry through as a thread throughout the book.
So, yeah, I did. I had a couple questions about the issues of race. I was wondering if race would be a very large component of the book, and it is there through a lot of the book, and I thought you did a beautiful job of just having it be a part of the life that they are leading in this country at that time, in the South at that time. And yet, really, the focus of the book is the relationship of these women, and the racial component was sort of part of their world.
Yeah.
Did you have to work to kind of balance that out, or was that just sort of how it flowed for you?
I did have to work at that a bit, and as I said, I worked kind of backwards. And the second story that I wrote, the second part of the book is the one called Madam Librarian that takes place in 1957. And so when I was thinking about it, as I had worked backwards, I was thinking, oh, I'm going to write this as the story where she meets Cam, her partner, who's going
right
to become her partner for life. And, you know, when I first started writing it, it just seemed like a girl meets girl kind of story.
Yeah. Right.
And then it became clear to me that race was so much a part of this that could not be ignored. And then, you know, parts of Cam's personality became more apparent too, and I recognized her as someone who was she was very sure about what she felt about segregation and integration, and she had been much more active, and she had gone to, you know, eventually she goes to the March on Washington, so she's a much more vocal and much more, she's much more steady in her, you know, she's come to her conclusions already. And Ada is still sort of forming hers and is nervous about stepping outside of her cultural background. That then becomes a part of their relationship, which I thought was very important and comes up again and again.
It does, yeah. And one of my favorite stories or chapters in this book is the chapter with Mr. Brown, the teacher who you mentioned, mm-hmm, and I don't want to give away what happens in that chapter, but there is just so much wonderful and very subtle human nature in that chapter, and I, you know, beginning with Cam's desire to befriend him in the first mm-hmm place, to some extent that's just her being very friendly and outgoing and the person that she is. To mm-hmm some extent, though, I had the sense that maybe she wanted to, you know, befriend an African-American person, you know, and that mm-hmm was part of her desire. And then, as I say, I won't give it away, but he kind of disappoints them a little bit at a certain point. And there was just a lot of wonderful subtlety in that chapter. And I wondered if you could just talk about writing that one.
Yeah, that was actually a very difficult chapter. It had, some of them came out very easily, and that one was one that had many iterations. And with it, at first I was very unhappy with it that Mr. Brown didn't seem like, Robert Brown didn't seem like a very clear character to me. He just seemed like sort of a foil. And I really wanted to make him a full character. And so it took a lot of drafts to get that. And, you know, you pick up on something that Cam is sort of consciously trying to befriend this African-American teacher. Mm-hmm. She sees it sort of as her responsibility, but also she is a very outgoing person. And then from Ada's point of view, she's really trying to, you know, let this young man know that she's not a bigot, you know, because right. they have a bad first encounter. So then she's sort of backtracking. Ada is backtracking and trying to let him know. And that's very important to her, both in terms of her relationship to Cam, but also, again, from this moral compass point of view, that she doesn't want to set a bad tone with him. She isn't necessarily going to be friends with him, but she wants him to know that she is on his side. But yeah. she confronts certain, you know, she confronts racial bias of her own in that chapter, and you pick up on some of those subtleties. And I think that's, you know, I find that true. I found that for myself, and I know for other white friends of mine who, you know, you have certain things that you've grown up with. You may have this moral inclination to be an ally to African-American people, but there are certain things in our background that sort of pop out at unexpected times right. That we don't want to, you know, and we need to sort of think those through and get over those, as Ada tries to do in that chapter.
Yeah, it is interesting to think about the ways in which we might try to befriend somebody that's not in our normal community, you know, in our daily life, and how to do that without seeming like you're trying too hard and without, you know, making an ass of yourself.
Right.
And that was just a beautiful, also just the juxtaposition of how Ada and Cam encounter this person and how they each, you know, try to be to have a relationship with him in one way or another. So
right, and yeah. Cam does turn out being the one who is actually most disappointed in him, probably even more than Ada. Ada is a bit, but Cam has had higher hopes for their friendship, and
right.
Turns out to be quite disappointed in what happens, even though they do form an alliance of sorts for some problems that are going on at the school in terms of censorship of books.
Right, yeah. I wanted to just back up a little bit to the first chapter or story in the book, and mm-hmm. and that's when Ada is a little girl. And she is getting tools for her father, who's doing some work. I forget if he's under a car, maybe. But there's this great moment where she goes to get the tools, and then she brings them back, and she finds this horrible photograph in his toolbox that he clearly doesn't expect her to see. That's the photograph of a lynching, and I that was very powerful. And her mother doesn't know that she's been sent to get tools, and her mother says at one point, "Stay out of the shed. That's no place for a girl." Excuse me. And that was a really great moment, because that line, "That's no place for a girl," has so much meaning in this book. Mm-hmm. Did you think about that when you wrote that, or was that just what her mother said?
No, it's, you know, her mother has this very, I mean, Ada is not a lesbian or has a lesbian consciousness at this time of her life. That's going to right. come much later. But she's not a traditional girl. She's not a tomboy really, but she reads a lot. She has a very private life of her own in her mind. She has a friendship mentoring kind of relationship with the public librarian, mm-hmm. who is in fact a lesbian, or at least she's a woman who lives with another woman, and so you know, I wanted to think about, you know, girls who are not quite the traditional kind of girl, and how that might meet with a mother who's very conscious about wanting her daughter to get married. Her mother herself gets married at 17, so wanting the mother to be conscious that maybe there's something a little different about her daughter. She's as I said, an avid reader. She's a girl who's going to want an education. She's very influenced by this librarian, and the librarian who has a very active life and who also has been an ally for African-American children. So I think there's a sense in the mother, and I knew that she knows there's something different about Ada, and that will be clearer. That comes out more in the book. The mother isn't a very big character, but appears in flashback, and she does support Ada eventually going to college on a scholarship, and talks to the father, who doesn't want Ada to do that. He just expects her to get married and be a millwife like her mother is.
Right, right. Yeah, that was that whole chapter, and the photograph comes back later, and I was glad you did that. I mean, it wasn't. I didn't necessarily feel that it was necessary to bring it back later, but I was very gratified to know the fuller story of that photograph.
Mm. Yeah.
So yeah,
I think that's something that happens with, or I found this was the first time that I had written a novel in stories. So that each story needs to have an arc and needs to sort of conclude and can stand on its own. And a number of these stories were, several of these stories were published on their own in journals. And this story was a finalist for some prizes. So it does stand on its own. But then when you put these stories together to form the picture of a woman's life, then they have to have sort of an overall arc. And so I knew at some point that I wanted that picture to come back when Ada was a middle-aged woman taking care of her father, that this is something that, especially given her life and her life with Cam and her life in terms of school integration, that this is something she's really going to want to know about eventually. And so
right.
The truth about that photo then comes out when she's taking care of her father as when he's an old man.
Now, I wanted to ask you about naming characters. I loved your characters' names. Ada, for example, her last name is Shook, which is just a great last name. And,
yeah.
And then another last name is Lively, and one of their friends is Twig. I think it's Twig, right?
Twig, yes.
Yeah, which I guess is a nickname. But
yeah, right.
But anyway, I just do you spend a lot of time working on character names?
That one, Ada's name, came to me very quickly, and I actually was sitting, I teach at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, and I was sitting, I was getting my ID or something, I was sitting in the human resources office, and there was someone, a woman who was working there at the time, and I saw her nameplate, and it said whatever her first name was, and her last name was Shook. And I had seen it several times before that, and it's a very Southern name. It's not one that I was familiar with. I grew up in the North, and it was not a name that I was familiar with.
Okay.
So there are certain names that are very Southern, and that is one of them. So I do try to think about, in this book in particular, what would be more Southern sounding names. And that was one of them. And then Cam Lively, that is just a name that I've wanted to use for a really long time. And I gave it to a character many years ago and in a novel that didn't quite work out. I never finished it. And it, you know, it always struck me as a very evocative name. And so I, when I was writing this book, I gave it to Ada's partner. And it seemed like, I mean, it seems sort of obvious because she is much more lively than Ada. So it's kind of ironic at the same time that it just seems to fit her. But then her first name, her name is Cam, and it's short for Camellia, which is sort of ironic too, because she's not at all the Southern belle. She talks about coming from a very proper Southern, rich, old money Southern background, and her mother named her daughters for flowers and for Southern flowers, and so she doesn't fit. Her first name at all, but she does fit her last name.
Yeah, yeah. Now, when you mentioned that you had that name in another novel, you named another character, Cam Lively,
yes.
In another novel.
Yes.
So was it hard for her to become the character she became in this book with that name? I mean, was she very much like this same character in your first novel attempt?
No, she was actually very different. And I think there were a number of problems with that character and with that novel, and I think that's why I probably never finished it. She was not as clear a character to me in that novel, and I really I need to see the characters clearly. And I saw Ada clearly. I can see Cam, you know, even as we're speaking, I can see her very clearly in my mind. And so I think she was not that character, if that makes sense. And I think she didn't really want to be in that book, and she wanted to be in this book, and you know, then became a full character, and with you know, her peculiarities and specific traits.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I have a novel that I've just, I think I'm finished, and one of the characters wasn't working, and I just had to change her name and start over with her, you know, and the name was really holding me, I don't know if the name was holding me back, but that was part, it was all a package I had to start over. Uh-huh. So it's interesting to me that you were able to take this name and start fresh with it and not have it be still tied to what wasn't working before.
Yeah, and I like I said, I'm just thinking about that now, but I'm thinking that she wasn't really happy in that other book and wanted to be. It wasn't who she was, so she found herself in this book.
Now, I wrote down a sentence from the book, and I'm forgetting who said this, but I liked it. It's the sentence is, reading is like being in conversation with a writer. And I really liked that. And I wondered if writing for you is like being in conversation with a reader.
I don't think of it that way as when I'm doing it. I think of it that way afterwards. And actually, someone said that to me a long time ago when I wrote my first novel. A friend of mine read it and said that it was so, she had enjoyed it so much, and that she had heard my voice in it so much that it was like we were having a conversation. Mm. And I thought that was a really interesting idea, that she was picking up on the fact that my voice and my ideas and my thoughts and the way I express myself were coming out in the book. So I think in that sense, I'm not conscious of doing it, but it happens that way, and I know that people who read my books, who know me, will then say that, you know, that my voice is very clear, and so it seems like a conversation.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about this one. It's a craft question, but it comes straight out of the book. Could I read a paragraph from the book?
Sure.
All right. So this is from early on. And Ada is in the library. She's working. On Monday, Ada was getting ready to take lunch and leave the library in Mrs. Pierce's hands. She was hoping to run into Cam in the faculty lounge so she could tell her she'd been thinking all weekend about what she'd said about segregation. But her plans changed when, from the window of the library, Ada witnessed the attack unfold. And that was so perfect, because the previous section, right before a section break, sort of indicates that we're about to have more dialogue. She wants to find Cam. She wants to talk to her. And this was so exactly what needed to happen. You needed a scene. You needed something that really sort of made us sit up straight. And this attack is a playground attack, a black child, who's being bullied because they've just been integrated. The school's just been integrated. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about knowing when a scene is needed, when action is superior to dialogue. I guess dialogue is a scene too, but when action is superior to sort of a more passive treatment of something.
Oh, that's a great question. And I try to instill that in my students, and I guess I've done it in this situation. But I think there had just been a long scene in which Ada and Cam had this first, I don't want to call it a date because they're just friends, but they've gone to the movies together, and then Ada has they've chatted, they've gotten along, and then Ada disappoints Cam because she says she hasn't really thought a lot about segregation, and Cam gets very angry and doesn't really understand why a woman in the South who you know, is smart and is well read could possibly have no thoughts about segregation.
Right.
And so she kind of pushes her on that, and it's something that's going to be a sticking point for them over time. And I wanted to get Ada sort of immediately into a situation, not where she's going back and forth with Cam, because as I said, I saw this story first as a girl meets girl story, but then secondarily, as I got into it, I realized that it was really a story about Ada's how Ada addresses race and how she's going to address that in her life and in her career. And so it seemed less important to get her into some kind of scene with Cam, again, where they're discussing race. And then to she needed to act. She needed to take some kind of action and to show that she really did have a moral center, that she really was the person that Cam thought she was, but that she was somewhat afraid to act on her her own feelings about integration.
And then another thing that I loved about that scene is there are other teachers who are not taking action, who are being, arm's length from this bullying episode.
Right. Yes.
Anyway,
and
go ahead, Sarah.
I talk in that story about because through my reading, this is, I was very clear that a lot of teachers were not very interested in integration and were really against it. And in a later scene in the book, some teachers leave because there are more and more African-American students coming to the school. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to make it clear that there would be, some teachers who were willing to stand up and do the right thing, and then some who would either take a back seat or just turn a blind eye, even if a young girl is being bullied. And some who would sort of talk behind people's backs about, they talk behind Cam and Ada's backs about, how involved they are in sticking up for students. So I wanted that to be clear and to have that juxtaposition. And also Ada comes up against the principal who has, for all intents and purposes, seems to be on the side of the young black girl who's coming to the school. He walks her, he escorts her into the school. So he seems to be an ally to her, and yet not wanting to give too much away, but he goes back on that and is not actually calls Ada out for stepping in to protect Mary, who is the young girl who's being bullied.
Yeah, I think one thing that I really liked is that this book makes clear how hard it would be to be a hero. I think that we all assume we would do the right thing in a difficult situation. But there are a lot of people that seem like otherwise good people in this book who are not heroic in their actions, There are multiple principles that seem like they're going to be different than they end up being.
Right. I think it's that issue. They're sort of treading this weird ground of having to, they're upholding what the school district has said should happen, but at the same time they may have their own beliefs, or they may be dealing with parents, and they have to sort of walk this fine line between the different roles that they have to play, or maybe their own personal beliefs and what the school district has said needs to happen.
Right. They've got the politics that they have to deal with.
The politics of being an administrator.
Right. One thing that was really clear to me, and this is going to sound maybe kind of obvious, but knowing what people go through in their lives is not, it's not as strong a thing as knowing the people. And reading brings us closer to knowing people and to being able to appreciate situations. I'm thinking, for example, of the fact that one of the subjects you cover in here is the fact that, that gay people are not, or were not always protected, as in partnerships, in so far as like property ownership and stuff. And so if one person dies, their, partner wouldn't necessarily inherit if there was no will, that sort of thing. Those protections. And, we know this is a sad fact of history, and in some places, still the case. And yet, reading this, I just became outraged, and it's like, It's not news to me.
Right.
But I love that you were able to bring this situation to that kind of life,
Right. There's, the segment where, Ada is in middle age and she, is taking care of her father, and he promises her the house, if his house. It's not much to speak of. It's a little old mill house, but he promises to leave it to her if she will help him in his old age. Excuse me. And Cam can't really understand why she's going to do this. Ada doesn't get along with her father. She doesn't even particularly like him. But Ada really sees the need to have this property of her own. Cam has some money from her grandmother, but she feels very vulnerable. You know, they've been renting an apartment for years, and now they're in their 50s, and so she feels very vulnerable in that state, and really wants to have something that she can have into her old age, and something that if something happens to Cam, that she will have her own property, and she'll have something for her retirement, because she won't be able to work, you know, her whole life as the school librarian.
Right.
So yeah, I've been a student of history for a long time, and a student of LGBT history in particular, and you know, I think we read these things, but as you say, it pops out at us more. Fiction can make history or facts that we know, it can make it more powerful. It can make it more resonant.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what really draws me to historical fiction is that there may be things that you know, you know, that you've read or you've read articles about or something or even known people, but to read about it and to read about it in terms of these characters' lives and how it affects them, you know, can be a very powerful thing.
Absolutely. One of the things that I found myself thinking about as I was reading this book was the fear of other. And I suppose that the strongest way that it's presented has to do with people's, straight people in the 50s being afraid of what homosexuality might mean. And it brings out the worst in people. But I had to laugh when I was reading the section where Cam and Ada go to New York City and they've had all these warnings from their friend Lou. And, you know, she has the fear of other too.
Yeah.
She's like warning them about New York City and all of the dangers and you have to hold your keys and your fingers this way. That was a great chapter.
And Ada in that story, we find out that, I mean, Ada's almost 50, but she's never been, I mean, she's mostly been in North Carolina. She's traveled back and forth within a little circle of about a 3-hour drive from Charlotte. The furthest away she's ever gone is to Charleston, South Carolina, which is about 3.5 hours from here. So she has a very limited worldview, even though she's living in a city. Charlotte was not the city back then that it is now. It was much more provincial. And so New York would have just seemed like really the wilds, you know, of urban, you know, urban life, crazy urban life or evil urban life or something like that.
Right.
That there would be all these sort of urban legends about what could happen to you in New York City.
Well, and in fact, they do, you know, you have to be smart in any city and they do make some mistakes. And I thought that was also fairly realistic you know, how that's treated.
Well,
but there are dangers.
Yes. And I wanted to, I was very conscious that I wanted to not view New York City as Cam sort of has stars in her eyes about New York City and this is the place to be gay. And she says, this city speaks my language. And, you know, I think there's a lot of that's true about New York, but New York can also be a very difficult place. And big cities are not necessarily always havens for gay people. So there are some issues that come up for them in terms of their own personal safety. And that's something that people have to consider. I lived in New York for 20 years and had probably my most horrific experiences with people in New York and not here in Charlotte or in other places that I've lived. So it's,
as a lesbian,
you know, it's sort of it's sort of a trade-off. You know, people, it was not physical violence, but a lot of verbal violence. And it's sort of a trade-off, you know, and that's what I'm trying to show in that story. They live in Charlotte where they have to be very closeted, so they don't really encounter that. But in New York where they're able to be out, then you may potentially face this verbal or physical violence.
Right. Yeah. Now, you just said something about being gay, or about them being gay, and that reminded me of a question I had for you about the vocabulary. Mm. And there's a part in the book where a mention is made of the fact that even in this age of gay marriage, some lesbians don't like the term wife, and it just made me wonder about vocabulary and how important is it and how political is it within that community.
Yes. You know, I think I've thought a lot about that word wife. I myself, I'm married to my partner, but I find it very difficult to use the word wife.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of a generational thing. We've been together for a really long time, for 25 years. And so when we started out, people used the word girlfriend or lover most often. And then everybody was using partner, and now people use wife. And so it's these sort of changes that happen as we make progress within the LGBT community. And now, you know, I see young lesbians using the word wife with ease, you know, with strangers. Or there was a young checker in the grocery store where I go who was talking to the customer in front of me and just, you know, very casually was talking about her wife being in Colorado on a business trip. So I thought that was so great, you know, and
yeah.
Something that came so naturally to her that I stumble over. And so I do think there's a generational aspect to it of what we call each other. And I still sometimes use gay as shorthand, though that's not really very PC to do. I should be using all the letters, but sometimes because when I was coming out, people would use gay as shorthand. And certainly Ada and Cam use gay. They refer to themselves as gay girls or gay women or something, because that would have been more common to their generation, and then eventually they're using the word lesbian. But I think these things evolve. Ada would have a really hard time saying LGBT, but she's able to use gay and lesbian. But I think she would have a lot of trouble with using all the letters or even understanding why all those letters needed to be used.
Right. Yeah. In my interview earlier this week, I had another interview with somebody who was writing about Vermont in an earlier time period, and there was an expression I had never heard, and it would be probably what Miss Ruthie's experience was. They called women who lived together at a certain time period a Boston marriage. Do you know that term?
Yes, I do know that term.
I had never heard that before, so it's.
Yeah,
I thought that was interesting. Too.
Yeah, there's right, because there were a lot of couples, and some of there were a lot of academic couples too. So I've also heard Wellesley marriage, because there were lots of female couples at Wellesley at a certain time. That sort of, you know, we're not sure what their relationship was. We can call it lesbian now. We don't know how they perceive themselves, or
right,
you know, we assume they may have had sexual relationships. We don't really know, but it's not really important. The important thing is that they made their lives together, and that was the choice that they made. So
right, yeah. I wanted to ask you about the cover. It's a beautiful cover, and also about your title, The Ada Decades. So how did you come up with your title, and who did the cover?
The cover was done by a woman named Anne McMahon, who's also a writer. She's published a number of books with Bywater Books, and she does most of their covers and does a lot of covers for other people as well, and has her own business doing that. And she just does – it's such a beautiful cover. I was so happy with it. I've been happier with this cover than for probably all of my other books. And The Ada Decades, the title came to me very quickly. I think when I thought about doing this as a novel and stories, and I knew that it was going to, I wanted it to cover a long period of time and not just be focused on, as I said, Ada in old age or you know, her during the civil rights era. And so it seemed to me that was something that would get at the sweep of time, that we were really talking about the long view of a woman's life. And so it did come to me pretty quickly, which many many titles have not, and it seems to fit.
Well, it's nice because it also sort of reflects the structure of the book, because each story really is roughly, I don't know if it's exactly 10 years, but it covers each decade. I always ask my guests if they've read anything lately that they would recommend to listeners. Have you read any great books lately?
I'm reading The 100-Year House, the author's name is Rebecca Mackay. It's a really good novel. I think I'm enjoying it because it pokes fun at academia, and there's lots of sort of in-jokes about academia, and so I'm enjoying it for that reason. I'm also enjoying the structure of it because it's about a couple, an academic heterosexual couple, and the chapters alternate between her point of view and his point of view.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so I'm enjoying that quite a lot.
Have you read Moo by Jane Smiley?
Did I you have ever not read that. No,
because that's another one that pokes fun at academia.
Yeah, I love those books. I'm not very long in academia, but my wife has been in academia for as long as I've known her. So it's a world that I'm very familiar with.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and what are you writing these days? Do you have any new projects going?
I do. I've just finished a draft of a new novel. It's called Cleo Rising. That one took a long time to get a title for, but I think I finally settled on that. And it's a traditional novel. It's not being told in stories this time. And it takes place in 1983 in New York City. And it's an intergenerational story. It's about a young woman who comes to New York from North Carolina in order to be a lesbian, in order to live openly. And through various coincidences and things and connections that she makes, she comes to work for a famous feminist writer of the Paris Lost Generation. So it is this intergenerational story of how their two stories connect, how the world that Livy, who is the main character of the book, how the world of New York City lesbians in 1983 starts to look remarkably like the world of Paris lesbians of the 1920s, and how they have very, very similar sort of configurations and problems and drama and things like that.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah, so I actually came to that book. It's a book I've been wanting to write for a while, but when I wrote the chapter on New York in the Ada decades, I started thinking about the early 80s. And I remember I was a young woman in New York in the 80s, and I realized when I moved there, I was so fascinated by the fact that Juna Barnes was still alive. Juna Barnes, the writer, was still alive and living in the Village, and there was her apartment in Patchen Place. And I think that was something that really informed this new novel a lot and got me thinking about what would happen if someone was able to interact with an iconic figure of the Paris generation like Juna Barnes or Berenice Abbott, the photographer, people like that.
Yeah. Now, Chloe Rising, is that what it's called?
Cleo Rising.
Oh, Cleo, sorry.
Yeah, C-L-I-O. Cleo. Yeah.
So will that be published by Bywater Books, do you think?
I don't know. It's kind of too early to tell. It's just in draft form, and I'm going to a retreat workshop in next week in Virginia to sort of work on that and get some feedback about that, and some of my writer friends are reading it right now. So it's going to be a little bit of a haul before that gets into print, I think. So we'll see what happens.
Now, the publisher, Bywater Books, is I went and read a little bit, and it said that they are for lesbian readers. Do you expect your books to have a wider audience than just lesbian readers? Because that surprised me. I thought your book would appeal to all readers, really, certainly all women.
I certainly want lesbians to read my books. I think they appeal to that has been my fan base traditionally, but then I think a lot of a lot of straight people, a lot of gay men may be surprised to find that they have a lot to see in my books as well, and that there's a lot to connect with. I've had a number of interviews with straight interviewers who talk about how they might not have ever picked up a lesbian book, but the Ada Decades in particular appealed to them because it had so much going on in terms of social issues and the history of the time and a long-term relationship that, you know, they Ada and Cam had many of the problems that straight couples have and have to go through a lot of things like illness and taking care of an older parent and all of these kinds of things and deciding to move in together. And so their life is complicated by this, by having to be in the closet. There's that added layer, but that a lot of their problems are things that heterosexual couples would encounter as well.
So do you do most of your own marketing for the book, or do you get a lot of support from the publisher?
I have done most of my own marketing for this book. I worked with a publicist, you know, on reviews and on getting various interviews. And I did a lot of stuff on my own, just approaching friends of mine who are journalists or who might have contacts, you know, to get different interviews in, for example, the local paper in Charlotte. You know, so to get that kind of thing, I did have to do a lot of that. And I think that's true of most people in small presses. It's not particular to Bywater. It's just something that, you know, small presses have fewer resources to
right.
do that for authors. Though they've done they do a tremendous job in terms of social media. They have a great person who, really blasts stuff out on Twitter and Facebook and,
yeah,
other places and promotes my blog. But there's a lot of, a friend of mine asked me a question recently about how different was it to promote this book than my novels that I wrote and published in the 90s. And it's so much different. I mean, you're so expected to be right there involved right now. And before it was, you know, you sort of did a little book tour and that was kind of it.
Right.
But now it's so much, you know, are you blogging? Are you on Facebook? Are you tweeting every day about your book? So it's been pretty intense in those terms.
Yeah. I have really just one last question for you, Paula. And, it has to do with, I noticed as I read the book that, you have very strong beginnings to each section. Either they start sort of already in action, something's in action, or some action is promised, or they start in dialogue. I don't know. And it just made me wonder if you would have advice for listeners who are writers about how you begin, you know, like not your process, but beginning a chapter or beginning a book. Like, what makes a strong beginning in your opinion?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I as a reader really need to be hooked pretty early. And I used to think that was particular to me, that I would do this first page test of a book. And if it hadn't hooked me by the first page, it was probably not something I was going to read. But it actually turns out to be a pretty common phenomenon that people have to be grabbed pretty quickly.
Right.
And so, so I like to try to hook people in by the first paragraph or the first couple of paragraphs so that you know what's going on. Like, who is this action happening to? What is it? What's going to happen? And do you want to know what happens next? And so often that will happen by, you have to start in the middle of things, or you start in the middle of action, or you start with a really, someone asked me about the first sentence of the book, which is about the lynching postcard, that you start with a really powerful image or a really powerful situation or a powerful line of dialogue or something like that. Just trying to hook people in so that they stick with you and they want to know what happens next, because you want people to keep turning the pages so that they, keep being surprised by what you're saying.
Yeah. Okay. Great. That's great advice. I want to mention again, the title of the book is The Ada Decades. It's a novel by Paula Martinac, and it's published by Bywater Books. Paula, thank you very much for being on Write the Book. I really enjoyed speaking to you about the Ada Decades.
Oh, thank you, Sheila. It was great. I love talking to you.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author Paula Martinac. Her new novel, The Ada Decades, came out this spring from Bywater Books. You can read more about her work at paulamartinac.com. So this week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by Paula Martinac. She writes that observation plus imagination equals fiction. Paula's novel, The Ada Decades, got its creative start, as she mentioned during the interview, when she was on a walk in her neighborhood and she observed an elderly woman scurrying nervously into her bungalow. Raymond Carver said he got the idea for a story when he was on an airplane and watched the passenger next to him pocketing his wedding ring just as they were landing. Think about the action of a stranger that caught your attention. You observed it but didn't understand what it meant and will never know for sure. Let your imagination roam and explain the incident in a fictional narrative. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And then, of course, you can stream the show live each week at 993wbtv.org, and that happens every Monday at 3. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. Have a great week.